Welcome to the REI Diamond Interview, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom with Dan Breslin.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Jeremy Ricci on wholesaling to yourself and creative acquisition strategies. Said another way, we're going to talk about tax-free wholesaling on steroids, subject to deals, owner financing deals, private money deals, and combos thereof, respectively. I'm Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show, and each week I invite another high-caliber performer to share their unique experience as it relates to real estate investing. This week's guest is Jeremy Ricci. Jeremy is addicted to real estate. He is a local full-time real estate wheeler dealer and investor in the greater Philadelphia area. He left his information technology job to be a real estate geek instead. Jeremy has served on the board of directors for DIG, Philadelphia's Real Estate Investment Association, and ran the monthly Movers and Shakers Mastermind meeting. His passion and specialty has been in creative acquisition and finance. And in the first 10 years of investing in the Philadelphia suburbs, he had never bought a property that was for sale on the MLS and still to this day has never used a bank to buy a house. Kind of sounds like my story. He is co-founder of Addicted to Real Estate Agency, an investor-friendly brokerage bridging the gap between investors and agents. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the Reader's Digest version of how you got started in real estate, maybe what you were doing and what that first deal looked like.
So I kind of have two first deals, if that's possible. I didn't really think of it at the time, but my first deal really was a rental agreement where I was 17 years old and I was on my own and I wasn't old enough to sign a lease. I found an apartment. A realtor was showing me around and he didn't even ask my age. Found a lease for like $550 a month. I couldn't sign it, so I found two friends to sign it for me and asked them to both pay $225 a month. So they were paying $450 and I was left to pay the $100. And I told them I would take the smallest bedroom and fend for my own parking where they get the reserved spots. And, you know, I did that out of thrift. And I wasn't looking to get rich. I was looking to save money. So living for $100 a month when you're 17 years old wasn't so bad. I really didn't consider that a real estate deal at the time. It just needed a place to live. But looking back, it was pretty cool. So then it was really leveraging other people to get what I want, right? So really fast forward, and I said, you know what? This $100 a month to live somewhere is horrible. Let me see if I can get this to zero. And then my idea was to live in one, you know, get a duplex, live in one half, rent out the other. So that never did happen. I never bought a duplex and lived in one half and rent out the other, but I did get involved with the real estate group. I was referred to by a district justice, a judge friend of the family. And she said, you've always been interested in real estate. Why don't you go check out this group? So then I just did October 2001, went to a investor meeting. On the chair, they threw out a weekend conference with all these speakers coming in. I went to that conference and I spent $10,000 and I bought every single speaker's product that had it for sale, except for one. There's one speaker that I just didn't feel like I jived with and didn't buy her stuff, but I bought everybody else's. Basically came back from that. I was in Ohio, came back from that and just started devouring information and really educating myself early on. Let's see, that was November was that conference. The following April, I quit my job, never bought a house, but I was getting pretty close to buying one and quit my job and became a full-time real estate investor without ever buying a house. And I had a pretty good
nice.
Gig too. I was in IT. I had a good gig. I was probably making somewhere between $60,000, $70,000 a year at 20 some years old. It was a pretty good gig. And I left and I found beat up condemned house, just driving for dollars, saw like an orange sticker on the window that said not fit for human habitation, pulled over, talked to the neighbors, chased that rabbit all the way down 23 different directions until I found the owner. And turned out to be a good deal. I got under contract for $50,000. This first deal was a wholesale deal. And I found a buyer to buy it for $65,000. So I quit my job April Fool's Day, 2002, and closed my first deal. Closed my first deal April 15th, 2002, and I made $15,000 in 15 days. April Fool's Day, I don't think that was a sign, but April 15th certainly was a sign. April 15th, the day that you get a big check in real estate, just is a little bit of a reminder that somebody's going to steal part of that check.
Hmm.
And that's And that's the government with taxation. So that was my little reminder, April 15th, that you know, there's a big chunk of my money that was going to go away for taxes. So so I learned other techniques with creative acquisition that I pay less in taxes because of, and I hope to share some of that with you.
That's pretty cool. And I started out very similar. So let me ask you this question. I'm looking for a very brief answer when I ask it. Was it worth investing that $10,000 in that education early on, Jeremy?
You know, for me it was. I mean, I know people that have taken different paths, but for me, I just devoured it, and I had all these tools on my tool belt, and I went out into the field with these tools, and my plan was to, you know, make that money back. I mean, hey, I spent all this money. I need to make it back. I get 0% interest for 12 months. What did I do? I got 15 grand in 15 days when I quit my job, paid that all back.
True. Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, now I guess there's a lot more information available, podcasts, many more of these networking groups and so much stuff like Bigger Pockets online. But the reality was for me to have gotten around the people that I got around by making that, I think we went in on it with somebody and the total investment was somewhere around that $15,000. So our half was, you know, $7,000 to $8,000 to go to a series of seminars that were put on around the country by just highly skilled individuals who would be very, very tough to spend 2 to 3 days at a time having their most distilled information presented in a manner where it was supposed to be absorbed. So, you know, I, like you, saw my humongous investment at the time in real estate education as, you know, beneficial going forward. And even to this day, I'll drop $1,000, $2,000 and go to a seminar, you know, if it's appropriate for where I'm at in my career, whether that's marketing, business, or real estate related. I mean, I'm a humongous believer in knowledge, even if I have to pay for that good knowledge. So let's talk about what your business looks like now, and then we're going to get into some of those strategies just so people can kind of get a perspective of, you know, since 2002 until this point in time, and, you know, what have you built the business into today, Jeremy?
Well, we did something that's a little different. I always wanted to have I never felt like working out of my house. So early on, I bought some retail stores, and I put myself in one of those retail stores, and that was a phenomenal owner financing deal. But now we have two retail locations that have I Buy Houses tattooed all over them. And if you look me up on Facebook, you'll see them as my, you know, profile banners or whatever. People actually just walk in and trade in their house. They sell their house. I had a lady walk in not too long ago that had a mortgage statement in her hand. And I said, let me guess, you want me to take over your payments? She says, absolutely. So
wow.
It's pretty interesting. So having these retail stores, and we have these pickup trucks that are wrapped that say I Buy Houses. You've seen those before, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have some of those driving around. In fact, we got another one getting wrapped just this week. It's pretty bold advertising, and it's lazy advertising, you know, instead of handwriting letters and things like that. I rented a store, and I put a billboard up, and, you know, I figured I got to work somewhere, so I might as well have a billboard with some attached office space. So that's, we did that. It's a little bit, you know, different. We have mostly buy and hold. We do occasionally resell some that just don't fit our buy and hold criteria if they're too pricey, things like that. But we're mostly looking for a rental property, and we also need to feed our family. There's a couple ways that we do that through creative acquisition, where we get paid the day we buy properties, and we do that in a tax-free, tax-deferred anyway basis.
Why don't we delve into that? So that's the wholesaling on steroids, the whole tax-free wholesaling that we mentioned in the beginning of the episode here. So could you describe what that entails and how one of those deals would take place, Jeremy?
I call it wholesaling to yourself. And I learned this by accident in that I had a great deal. I got a tremendous discount on a property. It was worth $92,000 is what I had it appraised for shortly after I bought it. But I didn't mean to buy it. I bought it by mistake. I got it under contract for $25,000. You know, these deals like this don't come by very often, but it was a very juicy deal. I had a buyer. This is in Delaware County. I had a buyer that was lined up to buy it for $65,000 and didn't need much work at all. Just maybe, you know, I think I put $8,000 into it. But here was a wholesale deal I had under contract for $25,000. I was selling it for $65,000. The problem is the buyer backed out 2 days before closing. So I was going to make, I mean, that's a pretty chunky wholesale fee, $40,000, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I was going to make that fee, and the guy backed out 2 days before closing. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, got all freaked out. She says, oh, no, what are we going to do? I said, well, this is awesome. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm just thinking this through. And if we buy the place ourselves, you know, what I did was I went out and I scrambled together to get the money. I actually took cash advances on credit cards. I borrowed like $8,000 from my grandmother, you know, did whatever I could to get the money in a couple of days. And then I owned the property. So I closed on it. And then I was thinking about it. I said, you know what? Let me go down to the bank. And I went down and I got a line of credit. And the bank says to me, I'm sure you've heard this before, you know, we'll give you 80% of the value of the property or 80% of the purchase price, whichever is lower. And that's the thing I don't like about banks. They penalize you for getting a good deal. So
yeah, true enough.
I've learned early on to not broadcast my purchase price unless I'm on a podcast. I recorded a nominal deed, a $10 deed or a dollar deed. In this case, it was a $10 deed. So the deed says $10 and other valuable consideration, and that's what I recorded. And I said to the banker, I said, look, it was a $10 deed. So does that mean you're going to give me $8? and he said, no, I guess we'll just do an appraisal. So they did the appraisal. Nice. Appraisal comes back in at $92,000, and they gave me a checkbook for $80,000. I guess that wasn't 80%, but somehow they gave me a checkbook for $80,000, a line of credit. So
jeez.
I paid back my credit cards. I paid back my grandmother. And then the next check I wrote was to me for $40,000. So think about that. So I was going to wholesale it and make $40,000. Well, I still wrote myself a check for $40,000. I wholesaled it to myself. And not only did I get the $40,000, but it was also, there was no tax due on that because it's not earned income. It's the proceeds of a loan, right? So I had the $40,000 in my pocket. It's awesome that it wasn't subject to short-term capital gains. It wasn't subject to FICA tax, so you have to pay Social Security and Medicare and all that stuff. But also I got the equity that I was going to pass on to the guy that backed out. And on top of the equity, I got the cash flow of the property once I rented it. And on top of that, I got the depreciation from renting that property, the tax write-off. And I still had that $40,000. So it was a beautiful mistake beautiful happenstance that this guy just backed out of the deal. And that deal ended up being so rewarding over and above the $40,000. I rented it. I did a rent to own on it. I got another like $5,000 from the rent to own as a down payment. So that it was just a deal that kept on giving. And I later figured out that if I just do that over and over again, I can get cash to feed my family, but not pay taxes on it and get to keep the property. So I wholesale to myself. Just to give you a brief example, I mean, you do a lot of wholesaling, right?
Oh, yeah.
So think about it like you get a property under contract, it's worth 100, you buy it for 50, and you would wholesale it to some rehabber for 60, right? And
a lot of times,
instead, yeah. Yeah, instead, you know, let's say you need $10,000 in repairs. So what's the rehabber going to do? He's going to go to a hard money guy. He's going to go to a private lender. And he's going to borrow $70,000 to do the deal. He needs the 60 to pay to you. 10 of that's your wholesale fee. 50 is the purchase price. And then he needs another $10,000 to do the fix up, right? So I'm just using, you know, simple round numbers here.
Round numbers, yeah.
So instead of me going to a rehabber and making $10,000, I just go to the private lender, and I say, you know what? I was going to wholesale this property to Dan, and he was going to fix it, and he was going to come to you for the $70,000. So you know what? I just like to have you lend me the $70,000. I'm buying it for 50. I need to fix it for 10. And the other 10,000 is the wholesale fee that I would have made if I sold it. But that's the money I need to feed my family. So there's, you know, it's wholesale to yourself. You keep the deal. You make that wholesale fee. And the wholesale fee that you make is tax-free because it's a loan. And then the best way to repay back a loan is to have your tenants pay it back for you. So
yeah, you're right about that.
I found that as just a mind-blowing thing. I found it by mistake, and though I figured out that I could get all the benefits of this deal, including the $40,000 wholesale fee, you know, keeping the wholesale fee and and building wealth by owning real estate over years is a great combo.
I have a couple questions, so I want to get some details and clarification here. First question is the $10 deed. As a nominal deed, you went to a title company, closed the deal, correct?
Yeah, I go to a title company, and I always ask the title company, I just want to do a $10 deed. I don't think it's anybody's business what I paid for the property.
So the only other record of the money that was actually transacted would be the HUD. There would be something on the HUD, right? You would have to.
Yeah, well, Well, there's the HUD, but there's also, you know, in Pennsylvania, as you know, there's a transfer tax. And I'm not sure, you know, what the deal is with your listeners that are, I do know what it is in Florida, but I'm not sure what it is in the Chicago market. But transfer tax in Pennsylvania in the suburbs is 2%. In Philadelphia proper, it's 4%. So, of course, the tax man wants to know how much you paid for the property. So there's a form in Pennsylvania that you use called a statement of value. So when you record a nominal deed, you have to fill out this statement of value form, and you have to put what the actual consideration was and what the other consideration was. So you write all those down, and in that case, it was a $25,000 purchase. So I paid, because it was just out, it was in the suburbs of Philadelphia, I only paid 2%. So I paid 2% transfer tax. So if somebody digs deep enough, they could find what it is. But I kind of just want that transaction privacy, that I don't want somebody, you know, anybody can hop on Google, hop on the Board of Assessments website, hop on the Recorder of Deeds website, whatever it may be, and pull up the last sale of the property. And that's what I wanted to keep private. And also for that same reason, that's why I buy all my property in trust. I buy them in different trusts. And again, it's just for transaction privacy. If you see a flipper out there and he does 10 flips, 20 flips a year, and you look them up, you can see what he paid for it, which properties he bought, which properties sold, what the spread is, you know. So you get somebody's whole transaction history. I don't like that. I like to buy them in trust, and I record nominal deeds, and it keeps the transaction private.
Yeah, I'm 100% in agreement. And I remember the first time you and I think you presented on this one of the times I had heard you speak in the Philadelphia market, and I thought, oh, this is great. And then I ran right back to the title company, and I said, I want to do a $10 deed. And basically, I was told, oh, no, you can't do that. And they kind of stonewalled me. And I didn't push too hard because I didn't know the law or rules, and I hadn't done the research. I mean, would you have any advice for me to be able to overcome the objection by some title companies who may not be aware of this because of the normal, quote-unquote, standard procedure for recording deeds and the sale price in the record, Jeremy?
Well, there is Department of Revenue Transfer Tax Division has a little booklet that I have. It's the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue Transfer Tax Guidelines. And, you know, I'm a geek. I read the tax code. I read the guidelines. And I find out, you know, show me the rules so I know how to play the game. You know, Florida has a weird thing that if you sign a document and somebody accepts a document outside of the territory of Florida, there's no doc stamps. So document stamps is what they use instead of transfer tax. So you literally, if you're doing a big deal in Florida, like, you know, multi-million dollar deals, which we have some vacation rentals down in Florida. We have a little business doing vacation rentals. You know, we bought a $1.1 million building. You know, the best way to buy a $1.1 million building or higher in Florida is you find somebody with a boat, you go out 12 miles, you sign the docs, and then you come back. And at that point, there's no tax due. And it's a nice boat ride.
Have you done that?
I have not done that, but I did heard of a friend. I have a mentor that has done that. He actually hops in his plane. And then I have done them out of the state. So, there's no reason for me to hop in a boat because I'm buying these houses from Pennsylvania anyway. So I can do the documentation up here.
So you're already exempt from what cost, just so people have a basis, is the document stamp in Florida?
It's a lot less. Pennsylvania, you're talking 2 or 4% transfer tax.
Yeah.
In Florida, you're at, I think it's 7 cents for every $100. And, you know, the other thing that's different in Florida is they have a mortgage doc stamp too. So you have to pay, you know, in Pennsylvania, you record a mortgage. All you got to pay is those recording fees. In Florida, you have to pay a tax based on the amount of the mortgage. And that's just
interesting.
Document stamps on the mortgage. And I want to say that's 5 cents for every $100, something like that. You know, as far as buying them and keeping the deals private, I use nominal deeds in Florida. I use nominal deeds in Pennsylvania. And I use trusts in both places. Florida has a great land trust statute. For the listeners that are in Chicago, I mean, that's the nexus of land trusts. That's where, you know, the Illinois Land Trust, that's where they came to fame in the United States anyway. And the other four or five states that adopted land trust statute. Otherwise, in Pennsylvania, they're just common law. So that's just another thing. I use trust. They call it land trust in some states. Just use that for privacy as well.
I think that's probably a whole nother episode we could have just on the trust. But I use the trust also. and it was actually written by Jeremy. It was written by you for the listeners that are on the line. One of the things, too, just to point out before we kind of move on to the next subject, but looking up the purchase price on the deal, I do that almost on every deal that I buy and that I look at. And I know if I buy a property, I don't know, say I buy a property and get a really good deal, $15,000, and I just close on the property. And it's a decent enough condition. Even if I put $4,000 or $5,000 in there and turn around and I sell it for, say, $35,000, or I do a minimal amount of work, it definitely hurts my negotiating position, especially if the other party is represented by a real estate agent and they go in and they say, oh, he bought it for $15,000. So unless I have the market rewarding me with multiple offer situation, you know, my position, my negotiating position, I lose some of the strength I would ordinarily have as a result of me doing it the old-fashioned standard way of putting the actual purchase price on the deed, because my title company just says, oh, no, you got to fit into this box. You can't do this nominal deed thing. You got to fit into this box. So I'm excited now to go and switch it up a little bit on the deals that I'm buying and keeping.
And the switching up you should be doing is probably finding a title company that knows enough what they're doing to be able to handle that. And, you know, you can show them book, page, and verse. Just pull up, if you're doing deals in Pennsylvania, I'm not sure about Illinois, but if you're doing deals in Pennsylvania, just pull up that realty transfer tax statement of value. That's the form. And the statement of value form exactly has on it, if there's a nominal deed, you have to claim. There's a ratio they use. They call it the common level ratio. So they take the assessed value, they multiply it by the common level ratio, and that's what you pay the transfer tax on. So,
on certain deals, it might cost me a little more in transfer tax. If I got it for, you know, $8,000 and the assessment was higher, I might pay an extra $400 or $500 or some number in transfer tax based on the nominal deed as opposed to.
Yeah, sometimes I've paid a little bit more. You know, that's a business decision. You say, is it worth paying a little bit more in transfer tax in order to keep the transaction private? But if you're negotiating deals and you're a wholesaler or whatever, I mean, you know, transfer tax is typically 50-50, right? So if you're the buyer, 50% of the time it should be the buyer, 50% of the time it's when you're the seller. So when you're buying a deal, make sure the seller pays it. When you're selling a deal, make sure the buyer pays it. So that way you keep it 50-50.
Got it. Makes sense. Just pass it on to the next one.
That's right.
I like it. So, all right, let's switch gears here a little bit. I know for a fact, just from experience, that you deal directly with sellers, and that's something that I do as well. So when we get into the next couple topics, Jeremy, I'd like to have, just so you know, a focus on the conversation that takes place between you and the seller in order to have these outcomes, if we could. So if you have any example stories you can share that include some of like the play-by-play conversation, I would be absolutely in your debt forever for sharing that on the show here. And with that said, let's talk about the subject to deals. We could explain what that is and kind of how one of those would look in an example. That'd be great.
Yeah, so if you're buying a property subject to, and I actually started out buying foreclosures, so there's a lot of subject to deals in my early career. If somebody's behind on their mortgage payments, one of the things I often offer is, look, I'll make up your back payments and I'll start making your payments from here on out. It's a little bit easier to convince a seller that that's a good idea, or it's a good plan. It's not certainly not the best plan, but it's better than an alternative of foreclosure. When they're behind on payments, because one of the objections you get if somebody's current on payments and you say, can I take over your loan, is how do I know that you'll make the payments, the seller will say. Well, if you're buying a house that's in foreclosure and it's already behind on payments, that's not really an objection that comes up as much, because they're not making the payments. How do I know you'll make the payments? Well, you're not making them. So how about I start? So,
true.
You know, obviously I don't say it like that, but you know, I'm just saying the objection doesn't really come up as much. There is some confusion about it as far as like, when does the deed transfer and all that. I started doing like kitchen table closings on subject to deals where I'd have a notary come out to the house and whatnot. And I absolutely stopped that because I felt that when somebody was transferring their house, I needed to have it in a formal setting at a title company, at an office, done at banks, and had a notary, but at least in a setting where it felt like they were selling their house, not at the kitchen table. So that's something that that I recommend everybody do, is actually go to a settlement, you know, go to a settlement table at a neutral location. The title company is great. I've done it at the bank. Recently, the banks haven't liked to notarize anything to do with a real estate transaction, so we just, you know, do it with the title company these days. So as far as the, you know, the other conversation with the seller, I mean, they have, I explained to them the risks and I said to them, I said, look, this is a risk for me and it's a risk for you. Your loan most likely has a due on sale clause, a clause that says that if you sell the property to somebody else, that loan is may, and this is the key word, may be called due. It doesn't say it will be called due. With the, if you look at the Fannie Mae document, I want to say it's paragraph 19 on a traditional Fannie Mae document. It says on the mortgage, it says that if the property transfers, the loan, the lender may, at its option, call the loan due. So may and at its option, it's almost like a double wimpy sentence. It's not a very forceful sentence, right? So you have to go over that with them. We have disclosures like a CYA form that we fill out that says things as simple as, from this day on, I'll no longer own the house, and you know, fill in the date. I understand that there's risk both to the buyer and the seller, and given all our other choices, we decide to do the deal this way because we feel it's in our best interest. People don't have a lot of options. They owe what the house is worth, or they're behind on payments. I had one couple that didn't want the house anymore, and the payments were current, but they had filed a bankruptcy, so they actually didn't even have a personal obligation to the debt anymore. The house and the debt was owed against the house, but they didn't have a personal guarantee because that personal guarantee was wiped out in the Chapter 7 bankruptcy they did. So taking over the loans is a great way to buy houses without your own money and without the support of banks. And what more can I tell you? Any other questions you have about the seller interaction?
I think you covered it. It sounds to me like when you talk about the risk for me and the risk for you, that's a powerful, truthful position. And I know that I've done a few of these subject to deals as well. And just like you said, I mean, you know, I've made the offer to do a subject to take over somebody's mortgage payment. And if they're current on the loan, I've even had a few people who are behind on the loan. But as soon as I describe, well, the loan's going to have to stay in your name, they're going to transfer the deed. You know, a lot of times the deal falls apart at that point. But in positioning as, oh, this is a risk for me and this is a risk for you, I think you're overcoming some of that. But maybe you could talk about that other one. So let's say we got the person behind in payments, 1 or 2 months behind. And, you know, a lot of times the person is in denial. Stuff's really falling apart in their life. They didn't plan on being in that situation to begin with. And then, you know, I have to explain that the loan's going to stay in their name. So do you have any examples of how you've overcome that objection on a subject to deal?
So one of the things is like a third party validation. And if you look at line on a HUD 1 statement, the old HUD 1, now I don't know about these new fancy paperwork they're using. I haven't used them yet. But on the HUD 1, when they bought the house, there's a line item. It's usually, I want to say it's like 203 and 503. What I say to sellers is, you know, grab your house documents when you bought the place. You know, let me see those. Because number one, I want to look at the note and make sure that the note is one that I want to buy the house subject to the note and mortgage. I want to read the note and see what it says and make sure it's a note that I'm willing to take over, right? I don't want something with some screwy, balloon in 3 years or adjustable rate that bumps up, you know, to 12% or something like that. So I want to see the note. And I ask them to bring their house papers. And the other thing that I look at is their HUD 1 settlement sheet, and I show them. I said, look, it used to be back in the day that loans were assumable. And what that meant is you applied to the bank and you got approved to assume a loan. VA loans, I think, last were assumable maybe in 87 or 89, somewhere around that range. But after that, they really aren't. They used to be assumable without qualifying. These days, they're still assumable. Some loans are assumable with qualifying. And I tell them, like, look, I'm not going to go qualify with your bank to take over the loan. The loans, I'll make payments and I'll make the promise to you that I'll make the payments, but I'm not making the promise to the bank. And because they used to have assumable loans, these days they call it subject to. I'd be buying the property subject to your mortgage. In other words, I'd be subjecting myself to the terms of your mortgage. And I say, if you take out your HUD 1 settlement sheet and you look at these lines 203 and 503, see right here, it'll say existing loans taken subject to. And it's pretty powerful to show them, like, look, back when you bought the property, the federal government HUD on their form number one, HUD 1, has right here subject to. It's listed as one of the line items. So I think it's a powerful thing to demonstrate and show that to them. It's like a third party validation that this subject to thing is not you know, some screwy scam. It actually is, you know, it's not the ideal situation, but here it is. They allow for it right on the HUD. So take out a HUD and take a look at that and see if you, you know, pull up that line and you'd be surprised. You know, I think a lot of people are surprised to see it there, but it's there.
Yeah, that's great. So you're literally getting the paperwork like at your conversation with them, either in the showing or if they're coming into your office. Like when we're going to sit down and talk about this thing or this potential solution, I'm having the seller bring their house paperwork, correct?
Yeah, they bring their paperwork with them, and I show them where it says subject to on the HUD, and that's all part of me, you know. And there's also like the, I don't know, you know, as a buyer, I'm saying to them, you know, I need to look at the loan because I'm not certain. I want to make sure your loan is something I'm willing to accept. So it's almost like a takeaway, saying I'm not even sure that I want to take over your loan. I need to see the document and see all the clauses to see if it's even something that makes sense for me. So I think that's powerful too, you know, that you're, it's almost like, you know, you're saying, I'm not sure that I want to do this until I review everything. And certainly you want to make sure the loan is good terms and that it's the rent that you're going to accept on the property is higher than the mortgage payment that you'll pay.
At least, absolutely.
Yeah. And you also want to find out, make sure that, you know, are the taxes and the insurance, are they escrowed into that subject to loan or are they paid outside of the loan? And when you're figuring out your cash flow, obviously that if you think you have to pay the taxes and the insurance separately, and then you add the figures together, you're going to find out that you're going to fall short where you, man, I can't rent this for $1,600 a month. And then you look at the loan document and you say, oh, no, it already includes taxes and insurance. So the payment's $1,200. Okay, you know, total. But that's, you know, that's, you have to know what's in the loan in order to know if you want to take it over.
Do you order title on your subject to transactions or just pay them a closing fee to basically notarize the documents?
I always order title. I recommend everybody get title insurance. Do I get it every time? No. But I recommend everybody else do. No. You have to look at it from a business perspective and say, if somebody's handing you their house and they're current on payments or they're behind a couple payments, and let's say it's a $200,000 house with a $200,000 loan on it, and you're putting up a couple grand, $3,000, let's say, to bring it current, you have to say, am I going to go to the title company and pay, you know, over $1,000, what is it, for maybe $1,500 to get a title policy to insure the $3,000 that I just put up? You know, that's kind of silly. But I do want to look at the title, so I do want to pay them to do a last owner search. And you know that the lender that whose loan you're taking over subject to, they most likely, 90% chance that they got a title policy to protect themselves as a lien holder, right? So they got a lender's policy. So you just have to look at anything that came after that and see if there's any judgments, see if there's any other mortgages, any other lines of credit that was taken out. And if that search, if I pay for that search, you know, for me, I just go to the searchers directly at the courthouse. I don't use the title company. I have searchers that work at the different courthouses that I've made a relationship with. I went in and asked them, hey, I'd like to see how you do a title search. And I gave the guy $100. And I said, could you show me one? Go through one. And he went through the whole thing with me and taught me how to do it. I've never really done it myself after that, but I thought it was great to know exactly what those guys do when they do title searches. And then from here on out, I pay him $50 to do like a last owner search. And I just pay that directly to the guy that the title companies hire at the courthouse.
Got it.
You know, let's say if it's a big rehab, you're taking a property subject to and you're putting $30,000 into rehab. Now, that's a different story. Now your $30,000 is at risk, not just a couple grand, right? So then you have to make a decision. Do I want to spend $1,500 in title insurance to insure that $30,000? You know, as the numbers change, so might your decision change on whether or not you insure the risk.
So another one of the topics that I know you're very proficient at would be owner finance deals. And maybe you can take us through the same way you have that presentation where you're getting the paperwork and you're running through each detail. I imagine that you have a step-by-step similar process when you're doing an owner finance deal. Can you kind of take us through one of those examples, Jeremy?
Yeah, I have a mentor down in Florida that his name is Pete Fortunato. If your listeners have never heard Pete speak, I recommend they hop on a plane. And anytime, I think he's speaking in April, but anytime he speaks, he's just the most brilliant guy I know. And I learned most of my creative acquisition techniques from Pete. And he taught me, this is pretty profound to me, is that people say they want cash, but they really don't. What they want is what the cash can do for them. He said, you know, if you pile up, let's say you want $100,000 for your house. If we were to just pile up that $100,000 on your dining room table, could I come back and look at it 3 months from now? Could I come back and look at it a year from now? And of course, the answer is no. They're going to do something with that money, right? So you have to find out what people really want. It's not the money. It's what the money can get that can get them. Maybe they have a kid that's going to college. Maybe they have some credit card bills that they want to pay off. And it's important to whittle it down. When you're wholesalers go in and rehabbers go in, and the only thing that those guys have to do, have to negotiate, is price. That's the only thing. They need to buy it cheap because they're going to turn around and resell it. But if you're a buy and hold investor and you really want to build wealth, it's more important that you get good terms than you do get a good price. You can get both. You can get a good price and good terms. But the terms are much, much more important. The first office that I bought is a great example. The gentleman wanted $100,000 for this little, these little retail stores, and they were run down. And I asked for months and months, we were negotiating. I wanted to give him 70. He wanted 100. We just couldn't meet anywhere. And then I finally asked him, I said, if I give you the 100 grand, what are you going to do with the money? And he said, first thing he said, well, it's none of your business. I said, well, it's my money. I want to know what you're going to do with it. He eventually told me, he said, look, I need to get a new car. So I'm going to buy a car. And, you know, that's going to cost me whatever, 30 grand. I want to be able to have enough money to pay the taxes on my personal residence. And I need to be able to pay for my car insurance. And I told him, his name was Ron. I said, Ron, you know, those problems aren't chunky problems. Those are a car payment. Surely you could buy a car for $30,000, but also you could buy one for $300 a month. So I took him through that. And I said, look, if I were to give you enough money every month that you could pay for the car payment on your car, and enough money every month that at the end of the year, you'd have enough for your tax bill on your home, and enough money every month that covered your insurance for your car, is there any reason we couldn't do a deal where you owner finance this house at a payment that covers all those expenses that you told me about? And we added it up to be about $630. I financed $99,000 with him, $634 and some odd cents a month for 13 years. And that covered his car payment, his insurance payment, his tax bill. And if I took the time to care enough about him to figure out what he really wanted and how I can help him get there. And that's what Pete taught me. He said, find out what people want and show them the path, show them how you can help them get there. And at the same time, help you get what you want. Now that $634 that I pay him every single month, and I'm still paying, that's actually almost over, but that 13 years of payments, every $634 payment that I make gets me $634 more in equity. Think about that. If I have a normal mortgage payment and I took it out for 100 grand, how much of that first monthly payment would pay down the principal? Like what,
yeah, like
60 bucks, 70 bucks?
Not even. Yeah.
Depending on what the interest rate is, right? But in this case, it was $634 a month until paid. So that 100 grand, this is really a time value of money calculation, because that 100 grand today is not the same as 100 grand drawn out over 13 years. So basically, he got the 100 grand that he wanted because he had a line in the sand. I will not accept any penny less than 100 grand. And then I asked him if he needed the money, and the answer was no. He didn't really need the money. He just wouldn't sell for less than 100 grand. He needed some cash flow. He wanted cash flow. So I gave him the cash flow, and he was able to tell his friends that he got 100 grand for the place. You know, that 100 grand came in installments. It came over time. So having that, it was a zero interest purchase. Having that zero interest purchase means that every month I'm $634 richer. And I have a tenant in that property that pays that payment. So the name of the game in buy and hold is borrow millions of dollars and have your tenants pay it back. And that's a beautiful thing. The funny thing, the second story about the purchase of the office is when I gave him the offer of $634, he said, that's fine, but I'm going to need $25,000 down. So what do you think my question to him was after that?
Well, what do you need $25,000 for?
Exactly. What do you need the $25,000 for? And he said, well, I have these machines. He was a leather. It was a, It was a shoe repair shop. And he goes, I have these machines, and I don't do shoe repair anymore. But what he did was he made these, like, Civil War leather goods, and he would sell them on eBay. So he used these machines to make these Civil War replica leather goods. And he said, I need the $25,000. I need that for a garage to build on my house so I have a place to put these machines. So I thought about it a second. I said, I tell you what, I'm looking for an office, a little I buy houses office, and it's just me. And I need a printer, and I need a file cabinet, and I need a desk and a couple little things. The office that I was buying was about 15 feet wide by 40 foot deep. And I said, hey, Ron, what if I put a wall up halfway back? I'll put a door in the wall, and you can keep your machines here and have them in the back of the store. And I'll have my office in the front where the window is, and so I can greet clients, and we'll just share a bathroom. And his response to that, well, you know what? Then I don't even have to move the machines. That would work. If we do it that way, I don't even need the 25 grand. So that lesson was find out what they want. And the 25 grand is not really what he wanted. That was a means to something else. And that was a place to work, a place for him to work on his machines. And by splitting up the office, I got what I wanted. I got a small office for myself. He got what he wanted, a place to run his machines. And then I also had, this was a little retail store duplex. There was another side of the retail store. I got a tenant for that, and that tenant paid the entire mortgage. So I actually, if you remember, remember back to the story where I was trying to live free in a duplex. Well, this is a duplex for an office where I had the office practically free. I had utilities, but I had a tenant basically cover the whole mortgage payment, and all I was left to pay was my electric bill.
So what did you do as far as ownership or leasing of that space? What length of time is he allowed to keep and occupy that space, or is that like forever now a partnership?
I gave him a 3-year lease for a dollar. I always forgot to go renew that thing, so he's still there. He's still there on a 3-year lease for a dollar. Now, there's a garage behind the place, so I did move the machines back to the garage so that I could move a second tenant into the building. We moved out of that office, and I moved down to a more prominent location. We have 52,000 cars per day at our current location. And just this past year, I bought the corner property next to my original office. It was an old dry cleaner, and we bought that. That was a phenomenal deal. So now I have that was one parcel in from the corner. Now I own that and the corner property. So it's kind of like Park Place and Boardwalk.
Kind of like working on it, right?
Yeah. Just parcel them up.
Are there any more parcels in the target there to make it something you can combine and put a Walgreens or something like that?
Yeah, we considered that. We bought it and put it up for sale. Now that I own the two parcels, we actually put it back on the market for a heck of a lot more, like $1 million. It doesn't necessarily take me buying them. It could just be a cooperative neighbor too. You know, if Walgreens has to buy, you know, surely if they come in there and they buy up the corner, I have one of the most important pieces, but they certainly need this square footage too. So, they might have to buy up the other pieces, but I put myself in a good position for that. But that's certainly something that crossed our mind.
One other question on this, this owner finance piece. Did you have a particular presentation or method for, you know, presenting the 0% interest rate? Like, how did you manage to either navigate the conversation where interest rate never came up, or on the flip side, overcome the objection where he wanted interest rate and you basically said no? Or did that just not even come up for some reason on this deal?
You know, in 13 years of doing this, maybe I guess 14 now, I've only had two sellers that I've ever paid interest to. It typically doesn't come up because I talk in plain terms and I say to them, look, I'll give you $634 a month for, and if we divide that by 100,000, that's 13 years. So I'll give you $634 a month for 13 years. And, you know, it doesn't come up. I have had people ask me about it on occasion. And there's a difference in taxation from capital gains. And I'm not an accountant, but I do geek out over the stuff from time to time. But there's a difference between capital gains and interest income as far as taxation goes. So if somebody says to me, well, you know, the IRS is going to impute a portion of this as interest, then if they want interest, or if they say, well, there's going to be imputed interest, what I'll say is, well, geez, the moment you start claiming any of it as interest, then let me know, because I'll start claiming it as a deduction. So most people, you know, if their accountant says, you know, I've gotten a call here and there from somebody's accountant that says, well, the IRS has this thing where they say some portion of that has to go to interest. You know, in this case, it's 1.2% or 2% or whatever it may be. That's fine. But typically a seller doesn't ask that. It's their accountant that might bring up that objection. And I've only had that call maybe three times ever. Yeah. The biggest thing is, you know, I'm looking for payments that my tenants can afford. And if they want to call a piece of that interest and make a piece of that interest, I'll offer them different things. Let's say they say, you know, I'd like to make 5% interest. Well, what I might do is say, well, how about I just increase the payment by 5%? So instead of $1,000 a month, I'll give you $1,050 a month. Does that work?
Mm.
And, you know, that's kind of funny math, but I just added 5% to the payment, which just means I own the place faster. It takes out a little bit of cash flow, but it'll be free and clear faster.
That's pretty smooth.
You can add, you know, you could say, well, why don't we just bump up the purchase price 5% and then I'll pay that over time. So think about that. What did you just do? If the place is $100,000 and you said, how about I just give you, if you want 5%, how about I just bump up the purchase price 5%? Well, when do you pay that last $5,000? If it's let's say it's $1,000 a month. At the very end, right? The last it's five more payments at the very end. So that's just a way to deflect it. And, you know, it's kind of funny math. But if you want 5% interest, how about we increase the payment 5%? Or how about we increase the price 5%? And sometimes I get that to fly. You know, it's silly, but it works.
Jeremy, what would be three books that you could recommend for our listeners, real estate related or otherwise?
The book that caused me to quit my job. Be careful with this one. Everybody's heard of that, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. But I actually liked another book that Robert Kiyosaki wrote called Cash Flow Quadrant. And it talked about the four ways of making money: the employee, self-employed, the business owner, and the investor. And those four different ways really opened my mind up to decide to be a buy and hold investor versus just being a flipper or a wholesaler, because it talked about your assets make you money versus your job makes you money. You can have a job or you can own a job. So that was a great book for that. I literally closed the page of that book and then quit my IT job. that was pretty powerful.
Cool.
Book for me. It was just a mindset.
All right.
And I guess the other one that's really a mindset thing is Michael Gerber's E-Myth. That was a powerful book for me. It really said, it talked about systems and how just because you know how to do the thing doesn't mean you know how to run a business doing the thing. So if you're a plumber, you know, just because you're a plumber doesn't mean that you can go out and start a plumbing business. You need to learn some other things in order to do that. And as an entrepreneur, you know, you wear many hats. And this kind of talks about some of the other hats that that you have to wear aside from just the product or service that you're offering. And the last one that I say was a game changer for me was Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. That's one that I recommend everybody read. And again, it has to do with automation, time management, outsourcing to foreign countries, some just mind-blowing stuff for me. I remember reading that on the plane. I was speaking in front of the National Real Estate Investors Association. I was doing a little technology presentation, and I got off the plane, and I went to the concierge of the hotel, and I gave him the book, and I said, could you do me a favor? Go to the local bookstore and buy me 10 of these, or if they don't have 10, buy me as many as they have, and bring them back. And he brought them back, and I gave them out to all the other speakers, presenter friends, and I gave to them. This was right after the book came out. I said, you haven't read this, here. So that was one that was influential enough for me to go out and buy 10 of them and give them to my friends.
Do you listen to the Tim Ferriss show, his podcast at all?
No, I don't. I don't, actually. I know he came out with other books beyond the 4-Hour. There was like a cooking one maybe and a health one or body one or something like that. I stopped at the 4-Hour Work Week. I got the updated edition of it, which I thought was pretty good, which came with some real world stories of testimonials of examples of how people implemented it. So that was a great read, but I haven't really checked out the podcast. I'll have to do that.
So I read the 4-Hour Work Week. A lot of that for the people who are listening and haven't yet. Basically, he put together his online business, what he calls a muse, and the goal is to run that, you know, remotely from anywhere in the world, and then he traveled the world. I took that, and I thought, oh, my God, I can somehow construct a business in the Philadelphia market where maybe I can be doing this from Chicago so I can be with my daughter, you know, in the city where she lives instead of right, you know,
shackled to my business there in Philadelphia. And I did eventually, I did just that. And I live in Chicago now. And that book was the seed of inspiration for me to put together, you know, the life that I have now in the businesses in multiple states. And then Tim Ferriss, I read The 4-Hour Body maybe in October or November of last year. And between January and February, right through the holidays, the 60-day period through the holidays, I lost 25 pounds, basically with what I found and what I listened to in that book. Now, I've been doing some other research and things too, but the stuff that was in that book was kind of like, all right, this was the final little piece. I had a, not that I was really overweight, but I definitely had a different goal, and his information was so impactful and right on point that I was able to drop those pounds very, very quickly. The 4-Hour Blog, I believe, is Tim Ferriss's podcast. And if you haven't checked that out, it's definitely worth checking out. He has some very interesting characters. It's not just real estate related, it's business related. The guy who played Dwight Schrute on The Office was one of the guests. Cascade, a DJ from Chicago, was one of the guests. So he brings a lot of famous people. I think he had, you know, he had actors on, you know, business people. And you really get to hear some deconstruction of these successful people in many different fields as Tim Ferriss deconstructs their mindset. So it's really an interesting podcast. If you haven't checked that out, I'll make sure to include a link in the show notes here. So, Jeremy, what final jewels of wisdom do you have to share with our listeners?
I guess the thing that I'd like to encourage people to do is stop flipping. Stop doing that flipping thing. Stop doing that flipping thing you're doing and start keeping real estate. Hang on to the stuff. The wealth is built by hanging on to real estate. Let it do its thing. Let it go up in value. Let the take the tax benefits of it. Let those loans pay down and really build wealth and have those assets make you money instead of your time making money. And early on, it's going to be your time, but eventually it'll be your assets that are going to give you the cash flow that gives you that passiveness that you can go in and do things like kind of like Tim Ferriss's book. It's like a lifestyle design. You know, you can do things and your time is freed up because whether or not you go to work that day, you get mailbox money. You can open your mailbox and the rent checks come in. So that was something that I would encourage people. Now, if you take anything from this, the wholesaling to yourself, if you can figure that out, you can figure out how to become a wholesaler and a keeper all at the same time.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. I wrote that down and I am going to meditate on changing my mindset slightly in that direction. How can people find out more about you, your company? Do you want to share some contact information, Jeremy?
Yeah, sure. The best way to keep in touch with what we're up to is our website. It's addictedtorealestate.com. It's addicted, the number 2, realestate.com. People put their name and email address in there and they get, we have a radio show that we broadcast in Philadelphia. We're on an AM radio every Thursday at 3:00. So that's actually today, and we're doing this interview on a Thursday here, so that'd be great. And WWDBAM, the Addicted to Real Estate website has a place you put your name and email address. You also get notifications of our radio shows and when we're doing public speaking gigs. We even put deals that we have out there to people that are interested in buying deals that are outside of what our criteria is. We also have a vacation rentals. If anybody wants to visit the number 1 beach in the United States, it's gosiesta.com. It's white sandy beaches off of Sarasota. We do vacation rentals down there. We've been doing that over the last several years. It's a great business, vacation rental business. If anybody ever wants to do a little mastermind retreat down at the beach, that's a good place to do it.
Would you mind sharing that URL one more time, Jeremy?
Yeah, it's gosiesta.com. And the siesta is for Siesta Key Beach, which was voted the number 1 beach in the United States. Better than California, better than Hawaii. It was voted, TripAdvisor just this year said it was the number 1 beach in the U.S. And it's because the sand is made of white crystal quartz. It's like nothing you've ever seen. It's eerie white.
Nice.
But it's a beautiful beach. It's right off the coast of Sarasota. And I try to get down there like a week every other month. Again, that's kind of part of the whole lifestyle design thing. If you're going to own real estate, if I had a row home in Philadelphia and the thing goes vacant, I don't exactly grab my wife by the arm and say, hey, let's go check out the row home in Philadelphia and hang out there for a while. But if one of our vacation rentals on the beach in Siesta Key goes vacant, I say, wow, honey, we need to go make sure the paint's not peeling down in Sarasota. Let's go. Part of that lifestyle design.
Thank you for coming on the show, Jeremy. I got a ton of information, ton of knowledge here. Appreciate your time generously.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
Absolutely. And to you, my loyal listener, thank you for continuing to tune in to the REI Diamond Show. Do you know anyone else who would also enjoy this episode? Send them a link. You can sign up to receive new episode notifications at www.reidiamonds.com. As a bonus for signing up, I'll send you my special report called 7 Sources of Off-Market Deals. There's also a public relations link on that page for those interested in applying to come on the show as an expert guest. That website, again, is www.reidiamonds.com. Thanks again for listening. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you next time. Remember, here at the REI Diamond Show, we're dedicated to increasing, multiplying, and protecting your net worth.
Thanks for listening to the REI Diamond Interview. To receive the REI Diamonds newsletter and interview monthly, sign up now at www.reidiamonds.com.